In June 1925, Mussolini had lauded the fierce totalitarian will of the fascist movement. Like much of what he proclaimed, it was bombast. He was well aware that will, however fierce and however totalitarian, could by itself provide no solid basis for rule. Activism and thuggery, which comprise a good deal of what this will amounted to in practice, might disarm opponents, but could in themselves build nothing. Despite his own radical instincts, Mussolini was astute enough to see that he needed support, as in the seizure of power, from forces beyond his ill-disciplined street fighters. He needed the backing of the established elites in the land, and he recognized that a solid platform for power had to rest not on the party, but on the state. He'd been either clever enough, or perhaps just lucky, in February 1925, while still pandering to the extremists in his movement, to alight on a solution to the problem of his unruly radical party bosses. He had made Roberto Farinacci, the most radical of all the provisional party bosses, the RAS, National Secretary of the Fascist Party. Farinacci was a vicious, utterly ruthless individual, though possessed of poor political antennae. He did purge some of his most disruptive radicals, helping Mussolini in the process. However, the public violence that he condoned, even directly encouraged, provoked a backlash, allowing Mussolini to dismiss Farinacci in 1926 and distance himself from the unpopular actions of the party. During the following years, under less radical but more administratively competent party secretaries, the fascist party greatly expanded. By 1933, it was nearly 1.5 million strong, in a population of about 42 million, but lost all semblance of a fierce totalitarian will. It was transformed into an establishment party, shedding its revolutionary élan in the process. Certainly there were those in the party, most prominently Mussolini himself, and also some of the regional bosses, who still harboured revolutionary ambitions. They guaranteed that there would be no retreat into merely conventional authoritarianism. In essence, however, the party had turned into little more than a propaganda instrument, a vehicle to orchestrate the adulation of Mussolini, an apparatus for social control, and an organization to uphold the power of the state. For in Mussolini's Italy, in stark contrast to the Soviet regime, the Monopoly Party, no other parties were permitted after 1928, was the servant, not the master, of the state. Everything in the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. Those had been Mussolini's orders in October 1925. The extent of state social and economic controls introduced by every belligerent country during the First World War had encouraged a growing belief, not just in Italy, that national strength could only be sustained through total control of society by the state. The subsequent demonstrable weakness of liberal political systems to cope with the immense problems that were the legacy of the Great Conflagration had bolstered such views. Mussolini's most prominent theorist, Giovanni Gentile, professor of philosophy in Rome and since 1923 the regime's education minister, spoke not of the fascist movement's totalitarian will, but of the totalitarian state. For Gentile, nothing beyond the state had significance. It embraced all facets of society. It was the embodiment of the national will. The totalitarian essence of Italian fascism concerned itself not only with political organization and political tendency, but with the whole will and thought and feeling of the nation. However vague and however unrealizable in practice, the idea was novel for its time. The construction of this totalitarian state had taken shape gradually, not overnight, in the later 1920s. It rested inevitably on suppression of opposition. political opposition had been quashed early in 1925. By this time, with opponents already cowed, that didn't take much to achieve. Only about 100 individuals were arrested. Most opposition leaders fled the country. The press was swiftly brought under government control the same year, and strict censorship imposed. None of this provoked much protest, though the Senate, which retained a measure of independence, held up the press law for some time. In 1926, after 4 foiled assassination attempts on Mussolini had been exploited to create a fervour for imposed order, all opposition parties were banned. So were strikes and lockouts. The communists kept their underground organisation going for some years, though it petered out to no more than a couple of 100 members by 1934. In 1929, the Catholic Church was placated by the Lateran Treaties. No trouble was to be expected from that quarter. As a sign of the new accord, Pope Pius XI exalted Mussolini as a man sent by Providence to liberate his country from the false doctrine of liberalism. Although the Italian fascist state had been made possible by the violence of the paramilitary armed units, the squadristi, the systematic repression needed to contain potential opposition was a task of the police and judiciary, neither of them in the hands of radical fascists or party activists. Earlier forms of state repression were extended and sharpened, rather than revolutionized. The political police, in practice beyond judicial control, were centralized. A large network of agents and informers, many of them voluntary, built up. Tight surveillance of dissent was introduced. Denunciation, usually anonymous, was commonplace. Thousands of police actions, often aroused by the denunciation of minor, if not imaginary, offences, took place regularly. Subversives could be punished by lengthy terms of imprisonment, or by banishment to remote provinces in the south of Italy, or islands off the coast. Communists were the most frequent victims. The former communist leader, Antonio Gramsci, wrote his prison notebooks containing some of the most important theoretical reflections on Marxism while serving a 20-year jail sentence, during which he died. The death penalty was instituted for attacks on Mussolini or members of the royal family. A special tribunal for the defense of the state was established in 1927, applying military law beyond normal legal constraints, and it dealt with over 5,000 cases in the following years. All this was certainly repressive enough to erase any real prospect of serious opposition to the regime from within. Yet, compared with some other authoritarian regimes, not just Nazi Germany or the Stalinist Soviet Union, domestic repression was mild. Franco's Spain, for instance, was soon to prove far more bloodthirsty. Fewer than 20% of the cases brought before the Italian Special Tribunal resulted in a conviction. Most of these were communists. Freemasons were also heavily targeted. Before the war, there were only 9 sentences of capital punishment. The death penalty for 8 others was commuted. About 14,000 anti-fascists were punished, often simply on police orders, by exile, confino, sometimes for long terms, though in practice often amnested after shorter periods. For much of the population, it was a matter of coerced conformity, rather than enthusiasm for the regime. Conformity was necessary to obtain a job or to acquire welfare benefits. Corruption and bribery of officials were its inevitable accompaniment. Those who were critical did well to keep their views to themselves. However, Italians who towed the line didn't need to live in dread of the knock at the door by the political police in the dead of night. Instead of being arbitrary and unconstrained, the repression was mainly targeted at anti-fascist opponents. That largely sufficed. Dissent was contained, opposition neutralized. There was much apathy and dulled acceptance of what couldn't be changed. But this wasn't a terrorized society like Stalin's Soviet Union. The worst of the terror was exported, deployed not against the majority Italian population, but against their presumed racial inferiors in the African colonies. The traditional props of Italian state power were co-opted for fascism. Mussolini had promised to reduce state bureaucracy. In fact, he extended it. The dictator had himself taken over 8 government ministries by 1929. He needed career civil servants to run them for him. Of course, they joined the party. But most of them were civil servants first, fascists second. In the provinces too, the state prefects, not the fascist regional bosses, were in charge. And they kept local fascist activists as well as potential subversives under surveillance. More often than not, quite especially in the South, notables from the established ruling class, most of whom were again fascists only on paper, continued to run the localities. The army, too, had to be kept on board. Plans in 1925 to reduce its size were abandoned, and the Minister for War, who had proposed them, was fired. Mussolini himself took on the ministry, and soon afterwards the Navy and Air Ministries. In practice, this meant that the armed forces ran themselves, with minimal coordination and efficiency. There was little that Mussolini could do to improve matters. The officer corps remained for the most part conservative, hardly fascist in true allegiance. The monarchy itself provided a bond of loyalty for conservative officers who were inwardly not enthusiastic about Mussolini. The generals and admirals, even more dyed-in-the-wool national conservative, were, in any case, more than happy to accept the imposition of fascist order, the repression of the left, and the manufacture of national unity, as long as it didn't interfere with the armed services. By the 1930s, the fascist regime had fully consolidated its hold on power. No worthwhile opposition remained. The support of the power elites, monarchy, military, church, captains of industry, big landowners, was assured. In practice, the idea of the totality of state and society never came close to realization. Fascism proved unable to win over large sections of society, not least the old socialist milieu in the big cities and wide swathes of the rural southern provinces. But where inward commitment was lacking, there was at least quiescence. People accommodated themselves to the regime. In its early days, fascism had found its main support in the middle classes. The middle class basis of backing for the regime became even more pronounced in the 1930s, as fears of the left receded, internal order was assured, expectations of improved status and material conditions were aroused, and the prospects of national grandeur magnified. The middle-class character of the fascist party itself was enhanced by recruitment of the large numbers of clerks, white-collar workers, and supervisory staff. For these and others in any form of public employment, party membership became compulsory in 1933. Whatever people inwardly thought of the regime, the quality that set Italian fascism apart from other, more conventional authoritarian regimes at the time, and won it many admirers, even in the Western democracies, was less its repression and coercion, common to some degree in all dictatorships, than its relentless mobilization of the population, its overt vitality and dynamism. This was represented in a new aesthetics of power that attempted to harness art, literature, and, not least, monumental architecture to its service. To many outside observers, fascism seemed the modern face of government, a rational organization of society. It appeared to combine order with state-organized social welfare. The fascist idea of the totalitarian state aimed to embrace all facets of life, from cradle to grave. It aimed to create a new man who would embody the spirit of Italian fascism, backed by the new Italian woman committed to her duty for the nation, largely envisaged as providing domestic happiness and bearing babies. The thoughts and wishes of the Duce must become the thoughts and wishes of the masses, said Gentile. The fascist party itself extended its tentacles into almost all avenues of daily life. But mobilization went much further than the activities of the party itself. Almost half of the entire population was a member of some type of fascist affiliation by 1939. Welfare organizations were set up to look after pregnant women and new babies, provide food, clothing, and emergency shelter for the needy. A youth organization with numerous sub-branches, founded in 1926 and with over 5 million members by 1936, indoctrinated young Italians with the requisite martial values. Apart from pre-military training, it ran popular youth clubs that offered wider opportunities and better facilities for sport than had earlier existed. Youth hostels were built. 500,000 children, many from poorer families, were sent on camping holidays in 1935. Schools and universities reinforced the indoctrination in a new value system. Most impressive, in the eyes of many Italians and foreign observers, was the novel creation in 1925 of a big leisure organization, the Opera Nazionale Dopo Lavoro, National After Work Organization, which had 4.5 million members by 1939, around 40% of industrial workers. This offered blue and white collar workers in factories opportunities for sport, entertainment, and travel that they had never previously enjoyed. Much of this was popular, though that didn't mean it readily translated into popularity for the regime itself, let alone the fascist party. Sport, in particular, was highly popular. The regime turned it into an evocation of national pride and prestige. Cycling and skiing became popular mass sports, strongly encouraged by the regime. One of the most prominent fascist leaders, Italo Balbo, showed off the courage and skill of the airmen by flying across the Atlantic. Primo Carnera was world heavyweight boxing champion from 1933 to 1935. Motor car racing, fostered by famous names such as Maserati, Bugatti, and Alfa Romeo, thrilled the masses, drawn to speed and power. Above all, football was well on the way to becoming the dominant Italian sporting passion and a propaganda window for the regime when Italy won the World Cup in 1934 and again in 1938. Italy's sporting prowess was advertised to the nation in newsreels in the most popular form of popular entertainment, the cinema, which could subtly and sometimes overtly transmit the values of fascism to its big audiences. The spread of radio, too, was a boon to fascism. For those without a radio, still most Italian families in 1939, thousands of loudspeakers were set up in town squares to make sure that, dragooned into attendance by the party, they didn't miss one of Mussolini's speeches. Mussolini himself was the regime's greatest single asset. Foreigners admired him not least as a bulwark against communism. No less a person than Winston Churchill lauded him, describing him in 1933 as the personification of Roman genius. The Duce cult was a careful construct. Only from the mid-1920s, with opposition suppressed and the mass media mobilized in the service of the regime, could propaganda give full expression to building up an almost superhuman image of a new Caesar. Among Italians, Mussolini's popularity by the mid-1930s greatly outstripped both that of his regime in general and the fascist party in particular. The Duce was widely idolized by many who were quietly critical of much of fascism and detested the party's overweening on often corrupt local bosses and functionaries, though even he didn't escape the growing political apathy and disillusionment with fascism in the later 1930s. What practically amounted to a deification of Mussolini in wide sections of the population could draw upon a transmuted form of naive popular religious faith. When you are looking around and don't know who to turn to anymore, you remember that he is there. Who but he can help you? Intoned the leading newspaper, Corriere della Sera, in 1936, speaking not of God, but of Mussolini. The article asked when people should write to the Duce and gave the answer, practically on every occasion at a difficult time in your life. The Duce knows that when you write to him, it's out of genuine sorrow or real need. He is a confidant of everyone, and as far as he can, he will help anyone. Many Italians believe this. Around 1,500 of them sent him letters every day. I turn to you, who does all and can do everything. For us Italians, you are our God on earth, and so we turn to you, faithful and certain of being heard. Duce, I venerate you as the saints should be venerated. These were some of the effusive outpourings from peasants in one province that had once been a socialist stronghold. The quest for imperial glory had been a hallmark of the regime from the beginning. The propaganda fanfare that greeted the invasion of Abyssinia in 1935, and the depiction of Italy as a country unjustly treated by the League of Nations, intensified the patriotic fervour in the land. Unsurprisingly, therefore, the victory in Abyssinia in 1936 sent Mussolini's popularity into the stratosphere. Tributes showered in from all sides, describing him as divine, infallible, a genius, a Caesar, and the founder of a religion whose name was Italy. This was, however, the pinnacle of his popularity. Internal police reports revealed it to be on the wane in the last years before the war, as a gap between propaganda and the experience of reality widened. Beset by material problems of everyday life, worried about the prospect of another war that they doubted the country was in a position to fight, and disliking the increasing dependency on Germany, many had by this time lost their belief in fascism. To revive the visibly flagging dynamism, and to show that fascism didn't lag behind Nazism in radical drive, the regime intensified its ideological zeal in the later 1930s. The fascist salute with outstretched arm was made compulsory in all forms of greeting. Civil servants had to wear uniforms. The army was told to adopt the goose step. The most visible sign of the new radicalism was the introduction of vicious anti-Jewish legislation in 1938. There had been no pressure from Germany for legislation, yet even so it was the model. At one time, the Nazis had looked to fascist Italy as their exemplar. Now it was the other way round. Mussolini had no wish to be seen as Hitler's acolyte. He wanted to prove that he was just as radical as the German dictator. Moreover, he thought that, as in Germany, singling out the Jews as an enemy within could help to cement national unity. Racism in Italy had traditionally been largely directed at black Africans rather than the tiny Jewish population of under 50,000, scarcely 0.1% of the total population of the country. But anti-Semitism, though not a central feature, had always been present in the fascist movement. And once Italy bound itself to Germany in the Axis, it became more prominent, culminating in the racial laws of 1938 that rested on the premise that the Jews do not belong to the Italian race. There was no notable protest. The anti-Jewish fervour wasn't shared by most of the population, but few felt strongly about it, and some certainly were won over by anti-Jewish propaganda. In this, as in other facets of fascist rule, the regime put down shallow roots in the population, but could reckon with the passivity and conformity of the masses. The internal affairs of the dictators, however distasteful, were seen by the Western democracies as their own business. Internationally, however, Mussolini and Hitler were by now viewed by those democracies as mad dogs threatening Europe's peace. Before the invasion of Abyssinia, Italian fascism hadn't been regarded as a grave danger. From 1936, linked with Nazi Germany as part of the Axis, it was a different story. The real menace, even so, was plainly the revitalized, unified, and strengthened German Reich. Hitler's Germany, the racial community. The rise to power of fascism in Italy, and above all the figure of Mussolini as the embodiment of the strong authoritarian leader who had crushed Marxism and united his country through force of will, had fascinated German nationalists long before Hitler's seizure of power in 1933. Mussolini was one of the few individuals who elicited Hitler's own admiration. Personal connections were built up between some leading Nazis and the Italian fascist leadership. The German greeting with outstretched arm, compulsory within the Nazi Party after 1926, was borrowed from the fascist salute. The deal between the Nazi leadership and the national conservative ruling elites that brought Hitler to power was reminiscent of that which had sealed Mussolini's takeover in Italy 11 years earlier. And long before Mussolini and Hitler bound together the fates of their countries in the Axis, the affinities of Italian fascism and German National Socialism were plain to see. The Nazi regime's big leisure organization, Strength Through Joy, set up as a subsection of the German Labour Front, the state-run substitute for the smashed trade unions, to provide an array of cultural and leisure activities for workers, was modelled on the Dopo Lavoro in Italy, created in 1925. The motorway, Autobahn, soon regarded as the emblem of the new Germany's economic recovery and modernization, took its inspiration from the first motorway, the Autostrada, which was built in Italy between 1924 and 1926. The German cult of the fallen in the First World War, the inculcation in the population of a militaristic ethos, the staging of huge rallies and parades as part of the attempt to construct a new aesthetics of mass mobilization, the creation of a youth movement to build a generation that imbibed Nazi values from early years, a panoply of welfare organizations, and, inevitably, the dominance of a huge monopoly party bound together by unquestioned allegiance to the leader, all had parallels in fascist Italy. The suppression of the left, and, of course, anti-Bolshevism, were also traits that the two regimes had in common. So, in contrast to the radical state socialism in the Soviet Union, was the promotion of big business, as long as it served the regime's interests. Both dictatorships were also not just stridently nationalistic and militarist, but quintessentially imperialist. For all the parallels, however, the regimes were inherently more distinctive than similar. That the Nazi regime was more radical, more dynamic, more aggressive, more ideologically driven in all it undertook, reflected crucial structures of the German dictatorship that bore only superficial similarity to Italian fascism. The exceptionality of the Nazi regime hinged in no small measure upon the ideological hopes, expectations, and opportunities that were embodied in Hitler's supreme and unchallengeable position as Germany's leader. The cult that invested heroic, almost superhuman qualities in Hitler, turning the one-time beer-hall demagogue into the object of almost deified veneration, was, of course, fabricated, just like the Duce cult in Italy, the Stalin cult in the Soviet Union, and leadership cults elsewhere. However, Hitler didn't have to transcend an earlier source of ideological legitimacy, as Stalin had to do in his nominal allegiance to the legacy of Lenin and the tenets of Marxism. Nor did Hitler have to build his leadership cult only years after taking power, as did Mussolini. The roots of the Führer cult were less shallow, of longer standing and of greater consequence for the ideological dynamism of the dictatorship. Already by the mid-1920s, Hitler had established his complete preeminence within the Nazi movement. By the time he was appointed Reich Chancellor in 1933, he had long embodied the utopian vision of national renewal and future greatness that had won over millions to support his party. Not for nothing was National Socialism known as the Hitler Movement. In 1933, his dominance within the party was transferred to the workings of a modern advanced state. And from 1934, he had total power in that state, unlike Mussolini, who remained nominally at least subordinate to the king. The fixed points of Hitler's vision, distant and imprecise future goals though they were, could now infuse all parts of the state, driven on as they were by the unswerving allegiance of the myriad affiliations of the monopoly party, the efficient repressive machinery of the police and surveillance organization, and supported in broad outline by the national conservative elites and millions of ordinary Germans. The personalized vision of Hitler, one premised on war to attain national salvation through erasing the shame of the capitulation in 1918 and the destruction of those he considered responsible for it, the Jews, offered guidelines for action that could now be turned into state policy. The twin aspects of removal of the Jews, an idea that meant different things to different people at different times, and living space, Lebensraum, entailing preparation for military conflict at some point in the foreseeable future to secure Germany's future economic basis and supremacy in Europe, an idea capable of embracing various notions of German expansion, served to sustain a relentless ideological dynamic. This ideological drive wasn't remotely matched in Mussolini's Italy, and was completely different in essence from what underpinned the manic upheavals in the Soviet Union. It followed no coherent plan or timetabled blueprint, but both the direction and the inexorable momentum of radicalization were intrinsic to the Nazi system. Central to the radicalization was racial cleansing. The racism of Italian fascism, even after the introduction of the anti-Jewish legislation of 1938, matched neither in centrality nor in intensity the mobilizing drive to impose racial purity that ran through the entire Nazi regime. The racism went far beyond anti-Semitism. Hatred of the Jews was, however, at its core. The Jews held a unique place in the Nazi panoply of phobias. For Hitler and many of his ardent followers, the Jews amounted to an all-pervasive danger that threatened Germany's existence. Internally, they were seen as poisoning its culture, undermining its values and corrupting its racial purity. Externally, they were viewed as a malign international power through their presumed domination of both plutocratic capitalism and of Bolshevism. The elimination of all imagined Jewish power and influence was, therefore, the very pivot of the utopian vision of national renewal built on racial purity. These pathological delusions could, from 1933 onwards, be turned into practical state policy. A nationwide boycott of Jewish businesses on the 1st of April 1933, followed by a first tranche of legislation to exclude Jews from the civil service and discriminate against them in the legal and medical professions, signalled to many Jews at the very outset of the regime that they had no future in Germany. A second big wave of persecution in 1935 culminated in the Nuremberg Laws of September 1935, outlawing marriage between Jews and those of German blood, and excluding Jews from Reich citizenship, the basis for a turning screw of further discrimination during the following years. A further wave, the worst, was to come in 1938 and would explode in the nationwide pogroms of the 9th to the 10th of November, sarcastically dubbed Reichskristallnacht, because of the shards of broken glass from Jewish businesses and homes. This resulted in further tens of thousands fleeing from the country. Before then, Jews had been increasingly forced out of the economy, robbed of their livelihoods and driven as pariahs to the fringes of a proclaimed people's community, constructed on the basis of racial discrimination and persecution, and gaining its very identity through exclusion of those deemed not fit to belong to it. As well as Jews, an array of perceived social outsider minorities, gypsies, homosexuals, the mentally ill, alcoholics, beggars, the work shy, habitual criminals, antisocials of one kind or another, were excluded from the mainstream Aryan community. The medical profession, welfare experts and law enforcement agencies needed little encouragement from the Nazi Party to play their own part in implementing the exclusionist agenda. Welfare and pro-natalist measures directed at the majority population, such as marriage loans, maternity aid, child support, even sterilization of degenerates, already begun in 1933, had their counterparts in other European countries. But nowhere else were such measures so radically and comprehensively driven by principles of racial hygiene to create a racially pure, genetically strengthened society, one being prepared, not that this was loudly stated, for war. With the enormous hydra-like Nazi movement, the racial ethos of the people's community was axiomatic. The Nazi Party itself, neither subordinated to the state, as in Italy, nor superior to it, as in the Soviet Union, but existing alongside and intersecting with the state in an uneasy dualism, saw to it that the pressure to exclude inferiors from the people's community, and the anti-Jewish momentum especially, never sagged for too long. The most crucial institutional driving force of race policy, however, had no direct parallel, either in Italy or in the Soviet Union. This was the SS Schutzstaffel, literally protection squad, the elite section of the Nazi movement and its most ideologically dynamic sector, committed to the pursuit of racial cleansing, both to improve the political health of the nation and to provide the basis for future German domination of Europe. From 1936, the SS, already running the concentration camps, which lay far beyond any legal constraints, took over the leadership of the security and criminal police, constructing a huge surveillance network, and eventually also developing a military wing, the Waffen-SS. By the mid-1930s, the repression to quell any genuine opposition to the regime, vicious though it had been, had achieved its goal. At the beginning of 1935, the population of the concentration camps, still mainly from adherents of the former left-wing parties, had dwindled to about 3,000, the lowest figure during the regime's existence. The camps, having served their initial purpose, could have been wound up at this time. That wouldn't, however, have suited Hitler or the SS leadership. A plain indication that the mission of the combined SS police apparatus involved a never-ending upward spiral of control, eradication of internal enemies of the nation, and the racial purification of the people's community, was that plans for the expansion of the camps were being laid at this precise time. The exclusion from the people's community of those on the margins of society deemed to be harmful to the people, Volksschädigend, saw the number of concentration camp inmates swell sevenfold within 4 years to stand at 21,000 by the eve of the Second World War. Alongside race policy, the drive to build powerful armed forces, militarize the people's community, and direct the economy towards rapid rearmament ensured a relentless tempo that was never allowed to subside. From 1936, the momentum sharply accelerated. Hitler hadn't wavered, as his memorandum to launch the four-year plan had demonstrated, from the vision of racial imperialism he had advanced in Mein Kampf a decade earlier. The premise that a conflict to acquire living space would at some point be necessary, and the empire would be won not in colonial Africa or elsewhere overseas, but in Europe itself. The idea remained at present just that, an indeterminate notion in the mind of Hitler and some other Nazi leaders. There were different interpretations of what living space might mean, different presumptions of the character of any mooted expansion. Some generals thought in terms of a strong army as a deterrent to secure Germany's defence. Others envisaged conflict at some point in the future to establish German hegemony in Central and Eastern Europe. Few, if any, in 1936, imagined war against France and Britain or an invasion of the Soviet Union in the near future. But even if little concrete thought was given to scenarios of future conflict, a big army wasn't being built up so as to sit indefinitely in barracks, and, unlike the undynamic Italian army, capable of eventually winning an imperialist campaign in Abyssinia but not much more, Germany's military leaders were efficient, experienced, skilled, and determined. They had imbibed a culture in which a strong army, national aggrandizement, and empire were taken for granted as the attributes of a great power. They had experienced war, conquest, and the occupation of territory in Europe between 1914 and 1918, before having to swallow the bitter pill of harrowing defeat, national humiliation, and devastating loss of great power status. They had been contemplating major war, anticipating all the modern machinery of death and destruction, even in the mid-1920s, once a new strong army could again be built. Hitler's aims and achievements to re-establish German strength, overthrow the Versailles Treaty, and pour countless millions into rearmament were certain of a warm reception among such military leaders. After the Western democracies had shown their weakness and divisions in 1935 and 1936, over the breaches of Versailles and Locarno, German expansion became increasingly likely. The second strand of Hitler's ideology, expansion for living space, like the first, removal of the Jews, was starting to come into focus. By every indication, the Nazi regime could reckon with wide popular support in the mid-1930s. Just how extensive the support was, as in other dictatorships that brutally suppressed hostile opinion and monopolized the mass media with regime propaganda, is impossible to quantify. But without doubt, the economic recovery, elimination of unemployment, restoration of political order, re-establishment of national unity and strength, above all, the patriotic triumphs, especially the defiance of the Western powers in the remilitarization of the Rhineland, were widely popular. Hitler's own popularity was immense. even among many who disliked the party and its local representatives, or were alienated by the attacks by party radicals on the observances, institutions, and clergy of the major Christian churches, Catholic and Protestant. Even bitter opponents of the regime had to resign themselves to depressed acceptance of the widespread adulation for Hitler. The march into the Rhineland took his virtual deification to new heights. "What a fellow, Hitler! He had the courage to risk something," was commonly heard, even among the working class of industrial areas, who otherwise had nothing good to say of the regime, but hugely approved of his actions to tear up the hated Versailles Treaty. Hitler was seen as a symbol of Germany's new standing in the world. There was simply wonderful trust that he would succeed in bringing everything to a good end for Germany. Propaganda could build upon pseudo-religious sentiment and naive popular piety, as well as belief in patriarchal values that would guarantee discipline and order. Each year, more than 12,000 Germans from all walks of life sent Hitler letters of praise and sycophantic veneration approaching adoration. Younger Germans of both sexes, even those who had grown up in former communist or socialist milieu, were disproportionately won over to the regime, soaking up Nazified values in the Hitler Youth Movement, which, as the state youth movement, became near compulsory by 1936. Many found excitement, adventure, and an impression of a community that transcended all class divisions. They had a sense of fascination, of a world of new and enticing opportunities and experiences that awaited them, and a feeling of entitlement as members of a special and superior people. "I thought it was a good time, I liked it," admitted one elderly lady many years later, looking back on her teenage years. She wasn't alone. Many Germans who had experienced since the war of 1914-18 rampant inflation, then mass unemployment and deep political division during the Weimar years, later recall the 1930s as good years. For the rest, terroristic repression had done its job. By 1935, the last flickering embers of opposition from the left were all but snuffed out. Socialist opponents, those who hadn't gone into exile, did what they could to retain clandestine contact with each other, but beyond this did little or nothing to disturb the regime. Communist cells continued to be rebuilt, infiltrated, and smashed, the cycle of courageous but futile resistance repeating itself to the very end of the Third Reich. But beyond the tiny minorities who were still committed to the perilous world of underground opposition, most Germans inevitably had to find ways of accommodating to dictatorship, complying with varying degrees of enthusiasm to the demands of the regime. Surveillance, snooping, denunciation, all the accoutrements of a rigidly controlled society were omnipresent. It was unwise to stand out from the crowd, for instance, by refusing to return the Heil Hitler salute. People were always on their guard. The pressure to conform was constant. But those who did conform were unlikely to find themselves in trouble with the Gestapo. Beyond the minorities seen as enemies of the people, Jews, the widening band of social outsiders, community aliens as they were starting to be called, and political opponents, terror played a far more restricted role in the 1930s than it did in the Soviet Union under Stalin. Most were content to be reminded that they were part of a unified people's community, with prospects of a glorious future resting on their racial exclusivity and superiority. Most shed no tears for outsiders, debarred from the community, least of all for Jews. Constant vilification and demonization of Jews in relentless propaganda didn't fail to have an effect. The National Socialists really have brought about a deeper gulf between the people and the Jews, adjudged a clandestine agent of the exiled Social Democratic leadership, reporting from Berlin in January 1936. The feeling that the Jews are another race is general nowadays. It was widely accepted that Jews had no place in the German people's community and should leave Germany or be forced out. There was no shortage of comrades of the people, as ordinary Germans were now known, ready to acquire Jewish businesses at knockdown prices, obtain Jewish possessions, or move into their apartments when they left. That ethnic Germans from other parts of Europe should join the people's community was welcomed, but few wanted to risk war to bring it about. For now, they suppressed their fears and hid their heads in the sand. It would soon enough be obvious to them that they were deep in the danger zone. Dynamic dictatorships in comparison. The three dynamic dictatorships, Stalin's Soviet Union, Mussolini's Italy, and Hitler's Germany, were in practice quite distinctive forms of rule, even though they had a number of structural features in common. Stalin's regime stands out plainly from the other two, which share more similar characteristics, and some borrowings by Nazi Germany from fascist Italy, though also displaying crucial differences. Each made a total claim on its citizens. This wasn't realized in practice, and most weakly accomplished in fascist Italy, paradoxically the only one of the three regimes explicitly to declare that it was building a totalitarian state. However, the total claim unquestionably had huge consequences for the behavior of citizens in such heavily orchestrated and controlled societies. Political space and forms of organized social activity, even compared with those in other dictatorships of the era, let alone liberal democracies, effectively ceased to exist outside what was permitted and managed by the regime itself. A ceaseless attempt was made in each of the three regimes to mold attitudes and behavior according to exclusive ideological tenets. Identity with the regime was underpinned and reinforced through emphasis on the enemy within, the outsiders, whose very existence shaped the creation of a community of insiders, of those who belonged. The penetration of society by regime values was lowest in Italy, in all probability greatest in Germany. The success of indoctrination was variable, though most apparent in all three regimes among the young. In each instance, the regime had substantial success in mobilizing large numbers of idealists and gaining extensive popular support. Quantifying the support is impossible, given the repression of all opposition on which each regime rested and the lack of freedom of expression. From the imprecise indicators available, Nazi Germany had the greatest level of popular support. Italy was some distance behind, while the Soviet Union was the most coerced population, suggestive of the least authentic support. Each deployed the heavy hand of terroristic repression. For those terrorized by the police state, the ideological or structural differences between the regimes were a matter of the purest indifference. Even so, they mattered. The Soviet Union exerted an extraordinary level of terror directed at its own citizens, far more than the other two regimes, an arbitrary, unpredictable deterrence not replicated elsewhere. Nazi terror focused on quashing organized political opposition, then increasingly on weak and small minorities, Jews especially, and other racial or social outsider groups. The worst of fascist terror was reserved for Italy's African colonies. At home, once the early street violence of castor oil and cudgel had waned, the application of terror was mild in comparison with that of the other two regimes, concentrating on eliminating known opponents, but otherwise largely content with a strategy of containment. Where fascist Italy was also weakest was in its ideological dynamism and its militarization. Much of the mobilization of society was little more than superficial. After more than a decade of fascist rule, the gap between rhetoric and reality was sizable. The aim of a totality of state and society had remained illusory. There was little underlying driving purpose behind the regime. Even colonial war and victory in Abyssinia, popular though the triumph was, had only a superficial hold over Italian mentalities and could mobilize the population only for a short time. Whatever the belligerence of Mussolini and the fascist leadership, there was little fixation among the Italian people on the prospect of war and military glory, and certainly little willingness to endure war's hardships and suffering. The Italian armed forces were capable at best of brief campaigns against inferior opponents, but they were completely unequipped for a major war. A technologically backward armaments industry wasn't capable of keeping up with the pace of rearmament in other countries. The ideological driving force in the Soviet Union was, in contrast to Italy, extremely strong. Enormous advances at colossal human cost had been made to mobilize the state-run economy, restructure agricultural production, and industrialize at breakneck speed. The presumption of war at some point before too long lay behind the extraordinary pace of these developments. Unlike Germany and even Italy, however, the focus was on preparing the economy and society for the military defense of the Soviet Union, rather than external aggression, though, admittedly, occupation of the Baltic countries and perhaps Western Poland was envisaged as part of building a defense cordon. As Stalin knew only too well, rearmament was only in its early stages. The Soviet Union was nowhere near ready for a major conflict, while he himself inflicted grave damage on the Red Army's leadership through the Great Purges. The ideological dynamism of Hitler's regime stands out from the other two regimes both in the sharpness of focus of its intensifying persecution of internal enemies, most obviously Jews, and its heated preparations for military conflict in the foreseeable future. Preparations that were plainly aggressive, not defensive, in nature. Germany had the most advanced economy on the European continent, one being increasingly and rapidly tailored for war. And it had the most efficient military leadership. Although between them, all three dictatorships were to play a disproportionately large role in shaping the future of the European continent in the years that followed, the leaders of the Western democracies unsurprisingly and correctly saw Germany as the overwhelming menace. Stalin was at this stage regarded as mainly a danger to his own people. Mussolini was chiefly a danger to the subjugated peoples of Italy's colonial territories in Africa and a source of unpredictability in the Mediterranean. Hitler was a danger to German Jews, but from an international perspective, above all, a huge and growing danger to the peace of Europe. The British government, especially, was mistrustful of and antagonistic towards the Soviet Union, detesting its social system and mystified by Stalin's purges. Italy was regarded as a manageable problem in the Mediterranean, increasingly hostile to Western interests, though not on its own a great threat. The main and mounting worry was Germany, a united people led by a ruthlessly determined dictator, rearming fast and with strength in armed forces already close to outstripping its military power during the First World War. In 1914, Great Britain had gone to war chiefly to prevent German dominance in Europe and to protect its empire from Germany's pretensions to world power status. It was looking all the more likely that there would be a replay before too long. Meanwhile, a chance presented itself in 1936 for a prior clash of the most powerful dictatorships in a conflict that many soon saw as a harbinger of a greater showdown to come. In July 1936, General Franco launched his rebellion against the Spanish Republic.